Hey guys, I'm Chastity, and this is the Ancient Conspiracies Podcast.
Unless we understand Genesis 6, in my opinion, it's almost impossible to understand the rest of Scripture. We go back to Genesis 6 and we read, the sons of God saw the daughters of men, and they desired them and married whomever they chose. And giants were born. The Nephilim were on the earth and also afterwards. And from that unholy union came the flood.
These were the watchers who governed the physical world before the flood. They were supposed to be helping humankind, but when they rebel, they commit these violations against the laws of creation.
Very powerful angels came down and they mingled with humans. So there was a saturation, an intermarriage between angels and humans, and then through intermarriage, this was spreading over hundreds of years until finally, by the time we reach Noah, he's the last specimen left that has a genetic makeup, his DNA, as God had made it.
If you asked a Jew, hey, why is the world the mess that it is? Why is human depravity so bad? They would say the real impact is the sin of the watchers. Because when the watchers sin like this, they also teach humanity lots of things that corrupt humanity.
Every major ancient civilization has a similar narrative of the gods, these entities, these beings descending from heaven and commingling with the human race, taking from among the children of men, wives, and producing, as a result, offspring that were not fully human and were not fully of the gods. These were the demigods, and in many cases giants, but not just giants, all kinds of beasts and creatures that came into existence that were not sanctioned by God. They were not sanctioned to exist, so they were wholly evil.
Well, welcome back to the podcast. Today we are wrapping up Enoch's third and final parable. We're literally at the finish line of season two and the conclusion of our Book of Enoch study. As I said at the end of last episode, we're ending this study at chapter 71 today, but there are actually 108 chapters total in the first book of Enoch. The rest of the chapters either repeat the same information that we've already covered, or they cover other material that isn't quite as relevant. So it's for that reason that we're going to end at chapter 71 today, but I'll post one more episode this season to offer a brief overview of those remaining chapters for those of you who are curious about them. As I've said before, the main reason that I felt it necessary to cover the Book of Enoch in as much depth as we have is primarily because it lays a foundation of why. Why are we told by God not to dabble in witchcraft and occult knowledge? Why are we told not to worship other gods? Who are these other gods? Where did they come from? Where did the giants come from in the Old Testament? What exactly are the principalities and rulers of darkness that we wrestle against, according to Ephesians chapter 6? And where did they come from? The history found within the Book of Enoch is vital to understand if you're going to study prophecy. I often say that in order to understand prophecy, you must first understand history. And the Book of Enoch expounds on this very history, which will resurface in the end days. And this is why it's important to know what happened in the beginning in order to understand the magnitude of what's coming in the end. As we've said before, the Bible focuses mostly on this history from the perspective of mankind's relationship with God. It starts out with mankind being created in the image of God, immediately followed by mankind's fall from grace, the moment that sin was introduced, which separated man from God. And the Bible concludes with sin being abolished and mankind being reunited with God. Whereas the Book of Enoch focuses on this history from the perspective of the angels. It starts out with the fallen angels making a pact to corrupt mankind by introducing the very things that led mankind away from God. They tempted man to sin. And therefore, the Book of Enoch concludes with sin being abolished, mankind being redeemed, and the angels being destroyed, which is where we find ourselves today. So the first four chapters of today's study, we're going to read yet another insert from Noah's perspective. Again, this was not part of the original writings of Enoch and was added much later. In fact, it's highly possible that this section was added closer to the time of Christ. Now, many people consider these inserts as corruptions of the text and completely skip over them. But as you're going to see today, there's actually some really fascinating information hidden in this material that not only expounds on what Enoch has been saying, but it was added in order to remind the reader of the magnitude of what the fallen angels did on earth in order to understand why their punishment is so severe. Now, when we ended last episode, Enoch witnessed the kings of earth descending into hell, and he commented that there were other faces there as well, a reference to the fallen angels. Today, Noah is going to recap some of that back history as to why these angels were there to begin with. He's also going to offer a bit more insight into the world as he witnessed it just prior to the flood. Let's take a listen.
Chapter 65. And in those days Noah saw the earth that it had sunk down, and its destruction was nigh. And he arose from thence and went to the ends of the earth, and cried aloud to his grandfather Enoch. And Noah said three times with an embittered voice, Hear me, hear me, hear me. And I said unto him, Tell me what it is that is falling out on the earth, that the earth is in such evil plight and shaken, lest perchance I shall perish with it. And thereupon there was a great commotion on the earth, and a voice was heard from heaven, and I fell on my face.
So in this opening paragraph, Noah picks up right where he left off last episode. If you remember from his insert last episode, Noah was given a vision by God where the archangel Michael forewarned him of the coming flood. Here, Noah is clearly back in reality and acknowledges that a pretty significant change has taken place on earth, which he believes to be a sign that destruction is already on the way. Now, what's interesting about this passage is that there's a couple different interpretations for what this change could be that Noah describes. Some translations claim that the earth had sunk down, whereas others claim that it was curved or had tilted. Basically, that the earth was in some way or another out of kilter, either literally or metaphorically. Now, the metaphorical interpretation could be that the earth had fallen into moral decline, which is what we're told in Genesis, that the earth was filled with wickedness and every inclination of mankind was only evil all the time. But if you think about it, this didn't just happen overnight. In fact, we read back in the Book of the Watchers that this corruption of earth took place over the course of hundreds of years. So surely this wasn't the first time that Noah was recognizing the corruption. So the metaphorical interpretation doesn't quite make sense. Whereas the literal interpretation of this decline is that a distinct physical change took place on earth. Possibly that the earth had tilted on its axis, which is what caused the foundations of the earth to shift and the floodgates of heaven to open, which is exactly what we see in Isaiah chapter 24. Quote, The floodgates of heaven are opened, the foundations of the earth shake, the earth is broken up, the earth is split asunder, the earth is violently shaken, it reels like a drunkard, it sways like a hut in the wind. So heavy upon it is the guilt of its rebellion that it falls, never to rise again, unquote. Which is likely a reference to the land disappearing or falling beneath the waters. And we're told in verse 3 that as Noah is witnessing this drastic change take place on earth, he cries out to his great-grandfather Enoch to ask what in the world is going on. Let's continue.
And Enoch, my grandfather, came and stood by me and said unto me, Why hast thou cried unto me with a bitter cry and weeping? And a command has gone forth from the presence of the Lord concerning those who dwell on the earth, that their ruin is accomplished, because they have learnt all the secrets of the angels, and all the violence of the Satans, and all their powers, the most secret ones. and all the power of those who practice sorcery, and the power of witchcraft, and the power of those who make molten images for the whole earth, and how silver is produced from the dust of the earth, and how soft metal originates in the earth, for lead and tin are not produced from the earth like the first. It is a fountain that produces them, and an angel stands therein, and that angel is preeminent.
Now, if you remember, Enoch was the first person in the Bible that was described as being raptured. In fact, we're told in Hebrews chapter 11 that he was taken to heaven without dying. We often think of his entrance into the heavenly realm as coming just prior to the flood of Noah, that he was faithful and therefore he was spared the experience of death that came with the flood. However, in the book of Jubilees, we're told that when Enoch had his son Methuselah at 65 years old, he then spent 6 jubilees with the angels, which is the equivalent of almost 300 years. In fact, when we're first introduced to Enoch in the Book of the Watchers, he's already in heaven among the angels praying when God calls him to intercede on behalf of the fallen angels. So not only was he spared the experience of death just prior to the flood, but it sounds like he was also given access to the heavenly realms for a vast majority of his life. And therefore, it makes sense that Noah would call upon Enoch, who would have been privy to heavenly knowledge and wisdom. And here we're told that Enoch not only responds to Noah's call, but he confirms that a command had been given by God for mankind's destruction because of the knowledge that they had learned from the fallen angels. And let me be clear here, it wasn't just that they had accidentally stumbled upon some secretive knowledge that they weren't intended to have. The problem was that the entire earth had become corrupt as a result of the knowledge that they were not only given, but that they went on to practice themselves. Enoch said that they learned the violence of the Satans, the adversaries of God, and that mankind was taught the most secret powers of the fallen angels, which caused mankind to practice sorcery and witchcraft, and also gain knowledge of metallurgy, which led to war and violence. And I just want to point out here that metallurgy is described as equally as dangerous as sorcery and witchcraft. If you remember from the Book of the Watchers, Azazel taught mankind the metals of the earth and the art of working them. From them, mankind were taught how to make swords, knives, shields, and breastplates. This is confirmed in Genesis chapter 4, where we're told that one of Noah's uncles from Cain's bloodline, Tubal-Cain, was known for forging all sorts of instruments out of bronze and iron. Here, we're told that they were taught about silver and how soft metals originate from the earth, how lead and tin are not produced from the earth like the others. And there's a very cryptic comment that connects some of these metals to a fountain that is associated with a specific angel. Now, it's important to remember that this was not material originating from Enoch. It was inserted much later, likely by the Gnostics. But I found Dr. Michael Heiser's commentary of this odd verse very interesting. He said, quote, "Scholars have been perplexed as to why these materials are associated with a fountain and an angel. One scholar has speculated that the silver could be understood as quicksilver or mercury, leading to the identification of the angel with Hermes," unquote. And if you listen to season 1 of the podcast, Hermes should be a familiar name. Numerous secret societies promote the idea that the fallen angel knowledge was preserved on pillars of stone that survived the flood. In the Book of Jubilees, we're told that Noah's grandson, Canaan, stumbled upon the knowledge and was able to translate it. However, the Gnostics believe that it was Noah's grandson, Cush, who found the knowledge and then shared it with his son, Nimrod, within 100 years after the flood, while Nimrod was king of Babylon. which, if this is a Gnostic insert added to the Book of Enoch, as many suspect it is, then it makes perfect sense that the Gnostic version of this history is what's being referenced, because it's suspected that Cush was not only able to translate the information for Nimrod, but that he became the primary teacher of it after the flood. In Greece, Cush went by the name Hermes. In Rome, he was known as Mercury, which is how Quicksilver or Mercury is associated with Hermes. And Arabic writers claim that Hermes came from Babylon, wrote his teachings in Egypt, where he was known as Thoth, and then he taught his knowledge to all the famous philosophers in Greece, where he was known as Hermes. And the knowledge that he was famous for teaching was alchemy. In fact, one of the most popular secret societies of the 17th century, the Rosicrucians, called Hermes the patron saint of alchemists. And in case you weren't aware, alchemy is the ancient forerunner of modern-day science. It covered everything from pharmaceuticals, chemistry, and metallurgy to psychology and spiritism, all of the things that were taught to mankind by the fallen angels, from sorcery and witchcraft to the inner workings of chemical reactions that allowed mankind to not only make potions from plants, but also to forge metals from the dirt. Hermes served as the bridge that reintroduced the fallen angel knowledge to the post-flood world. In fact, in most every ancient civilization, Hermes was considered the herald of the gods. He was the messenger of the gods, who in Greek mythology was said to be able to travel between the realms. In reality, he was considered a messenger because he could translate the information that was preserved from them and share it with the new world. So he translated what was once considered forbidden knowledge, and he turned it into what is now considered science. So what we're seeing in this Gnostic insert, although it wasn't a part of the original writings from Enoch, is really a connection of how the fallen angel knowledge resurfaced after the flood, so that we can understand the magnitude of it on the world in the end days, which is what Enoch has been describing. And what did we see Enoch describe in the final moments on Earth just prior to the return of Christ? Nuclear warfare. The kings of Earth using these same sciences to enslave mankind and to gain control and power. In episode 38, we talked about the kings of Earth having an abundance of confidence in their own strength because of these metals that they knew how to obtain, not only through gold and silver, which made them rich, but also through their advanced weaponry, which just goes to show that once again, mankind will use the corrupt knowledge that they were given to exact unspeakable violence on Earth, just like they did in the days of Noah, which is why God brought the flood. Let's continue.
Now after that, my grandfather Enoch took hold of me by the hand and raised me up and said unto me, Go, for I have asked the Lord of spirits as touching this commotion on the earth. And he said unto me, Because of their unrighteousness, their judgment has been determined upon, and shall not be withheld by me for ever. Because of the sorceries which they have searched out and learnt, the earth and those who dwell upon it shall be destroyed. And these, they have no place of repentance for ever, because they have shown them what was hidden, and they are the damned. But as for thee, my son, the Lord of spirits knows that thou art pure and guiltless of this reproach concerning the secrets. And he has destined thy name to be among the holy, and will preserve thee amongst those who dwell on the earth, and has destined thy righteous seed both for kingship and for great honors. And from thy seed shall proceed a fountain of the righteous, and holy without number, forever.
So here we see Enoch tell Noah that the fate of the world has been sealed and their judgment is set. There's no way to undo it. Not only will mankind be destroyed because of the violence that they learned to commit, but the angels who taught it will forever be damned. We see reiterated exactly what we saw in the Book of the Watchers, that no grace or mercy will be offered to the fallen angels for what they've done. They don't get a chance at redemption. On the other hand, Noah will be spared because he's guiltless and pure. He was untainted by the corruption and the knowledge, which is confirmed in Genesis chapter 6, where we're told that Noah was a righteous man, blameless, and that he was pure in his generations. Enoch also tells Noah that Noah's sons, his seed, are not only destined for kingship and honor, but from his seed shall spring a fountain of innumerable holy and righteous people. Here we see the word fountain again. In this context, it's talking about the godly people who would come from Noah after the flood, a continuation of people who God would ultimately make a covenant with. Whereas earlier, there was a fountain associated with Hermes, a reference to the ungodly people who would be produced because of the knowledge that Hermes revived. Quite literally, the fountain of knowledge, corrupt knowledge, that would lead people away from God again. So even though this section wasn't part of the original writings of Enoch, you can clearly see how it offers insight into what would ultimately follow after the flood. How the fallen angel knowledge would not only resurface, but would continue to be perpetuated throughout history, which, as you're going to see, is the reoccurring theme of today's episode. And if you think about it, this was possibly inserted into the book as a way of hinting at a version of history which is mostly circulated in occult or secret societies. As we said earlier, there are numerous secret societies who promote that this is how they obtained esoteric knowledge after the flood. So it's almost as though the Gnostics were giving us insight into their version of history, which actually helps reinforce what Enoch has been documenting. Let's continue.
Chapter 66. And after that, he showed me the angels of punishment, who are prepared to come and let loose all the powers of the waters which are beneath in the earth, in order to bring judgment and destruction on all who abide and dwell on the earth. And the Lord of Spirits gave commandment to the angels who were going forth that they should not cause the waters to rise, but should hold them in check, for those angels were over the powers of the waters. And I went away from the presence of Enoch.
So here we see the angels of punishment again. Now, these are likely different angels of punishment than the ones we've read about in earlier chapters, who were preparing the chains for the kings of earth. These angels of punishment oversee the powers of the water. And what's interesting about this passage is that God commands them to pause for a moment just prior to the judgment being poured out, quite literally. And he tells them to hold the water in check, which sounds eerily similar to what he does in the book of Revelation with the angels who are told to hold back the wind. In Revelation chapter 7, we're told, quote, "And after this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or the sea or on any tree," unquote. In the verses that follow, we're told that they were commanded to be restrained until the 144,000 witnesses are sealed, and then they'll be released to unleash the judgment on earth. In the same way, these waters are being commanded to be restrained, as we're about to see, until the ark is built to protect Noah and his family. Let's continue.
Chapter 67. And in those days the word of God came unto me, and he said unto me, Noah, thy lot has come up before me, a lot without blame, a lot of love and uprightness. And now the angels are making a wooden building, and when they have completed that task, I will place my hand upon it and preserve it, and there shall come forth from it the seed of life, and a change shall set in, so that the earth will not remain without inhabitant. And I will make fast thy seed before me for ever and ever, and I will spread abroad those who dwell with thee. It shall not be unfruitful on the face of the earth, but it shall be blessed and multiply on the earth in the name of the Lord.
So in these first few verses of chapter 67, what immediately stands out is that Noah is told by God that the angels will build the ark, what's referred to here as a wooden building, as opposed to Noah building it like we're told in Scripture. And again, we have to remember that we don't know who the original author is or what their motives were, but when in doubt, always lean towards the biblical narrative. In fact, Dr. Michael Heiser makes a comment that this is the only place in all of Second Temple literature that describes angels building the ark, which makes it suspicious. In Genesis, we're told that God gave Noah the instructions for the ark and that Noah did everything just as God had commanded him. And when the floodwaters came, Noah and his family entered the ark and God sealed them in. So it's widely purported across ancient literature that Noah was the builder. And as we see in the following verses, alongside the biblical narrative, God is described as making a covenant with Noah that his lineage would continue. And very similar to the Abrahamic covenant, God told Noah to be fruitful and multiply. He also told Noah that his descendants would be spread abroad, a foreshadowing of Genesis chapter 10 and the 70 nations that would ultimately come from Noah. Let's continue.
And he will imprison those angels who have shown unrighteousness in that burning valley which my grandfather Enoch had formerly shown to me in the west, among the mountains of gold and silver and iron and soft metal and tin. And I saw that valley, in which there was a great convulsion and a convulsion of the waters. And when all this took place, from that fiery molten metal and from the convulsion thereof in that place, there was produced a smell of sulphur, and it was connected with those waters, and the valley of the angels who had led astray mankind burned beneath that land. And through its valleys proceed streams of fire, where these angels are punished who led astray those who dwell upon the earth. But those waters shall in those days serve for the kings and the mighty and the exalted and those who dwell on the earth for healing of the body, but for the punishment of the spirit. Now their spirit is full of lust, that they may be punished in their body, for they have denied the Lord of spirits and see their punishment daily, and yet believe not his name. And in proportion as the burning of their bodies becomes severe, a corresponding change shall take place in their spirit for ever and ever. For before the Lord of spirits, none shall utter an idle word. For the judgment shall come upon them, because they believe in the lust of their body, and deny the Spirit of the Lord. And those same waters will undergo a change in those days. For when those angels are punished in these water springs shall change their temperature. And when the angels ascend, this water of the springs shall change and become cold. And I heard Michael answering and saying, this judgment wherewith the angels are judged is a testimony for the kings and the mighty who possess the earth, because these waters of judgment minister to the healing of the body of the kings and the lust of their body. Therefore they will not see and will not believe that those waters will change and become a fire which burns forever.
Now, the information given in the remainder of the chapter proves that this insert was added much later to the Book of Enoch, dating closer to the time of Christ. It's a very mysterious section that talks about the prison of the fallen angels in connection with water and fire, a convulsion of certain waters and fiery molten material, which when combined, produce the smell of sulfur. Now, scholars believe that this is likely a reference reference to volcanic eruptions or volcanic activity that produces hot springs. And in order to really drive home the magnitude of what's being said here, I need to give you a little back history. Origen of Alexandria was a well-known Christian theologian and scholar from the first century who wrote quite a bit about biblical history. In one of his works, he happened to reference a Greek philosopher named Celsus, who in his writings associated certain hot springs in modern-day Jordan as being the subterranean prison of the fallen angels that Noah is describing. And the location that Celsus referenced is just east of the Dead Sea, in a place which I'm going to butcher, but it's either Kaleroe or Kaleroe. Now, Kaleroe in Greek means beautiful spring, but in Greek mythology, Kaleroe was a female sea nymph, the daughter of the Titan god Oceanus. If you remember, we talked about Oceanus back in episode 33, when Enoch was given the tour of the abyss, and he described the exact location that would eventually serve as the prison for the fallen angels. At the mouth of the abyss, he described a great river, which the Greeks reference as the river Oceanus. In Greek mythology, it was believed to be near the mouth of Tartarus, the prison of their titans. And not only was this river of water associated with the mouth of the abyss, but there was also a river of fire, known in Greek mythology as Pyriphlegethon. So even in Greek mythology, we see this combination of water and fire in connection to the prison of the fallen angels. And not only that, but I found it interesting that Kaleroe in Greek mythology is a water nymph, in other words, a siren or a mermaid. If you remember from episode 33, the wives of the fallen angels became sirens. When Enoch was given the tour of the abyss, the archangel Uriel not only showed Enoch the location of the abyss where the fallen angels would be imprisoned, but he made it known that the wives of the fallen angels would be bound there as well as sirens. And at the archaeological site of Kaleroe, there still exists a monument consecrated to all nymphs called the Nymphaeum. And the location of Kaleroe was not only famous throughout ancient literature for its thermal springs, but even today they've built spas around these hot springs for the public to access. And according to the famous Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, King Herod the Great bathed in these hot springs under the advice of his physicians while he was ill shortly before he died, which may be why Noah makes mention in this section of the text that the waters around the abyss would serve the kings and the mighty for the healing of their body, which just goes to show that whoever inserted this passage into the book of Enoch was familiar with the history of this location and possibly even the history of Herod, and therefore it dates the author of this insert to around the time of Christ. And in the final verses of this chapter, we're told something interesting, that while the fallen angels are bound in this location awaiting judgment, the waters will remain hot. And when they are removed from this location to face judgment and placed in their final prison, possibly the lake of fire, the water will change temperature and go cold. Now, there's no evidence of this in scripture, so again, without knowing the author of this insert or their motives, we really don't know where this idea originated, but it's possible that these were myths surrounding the springs at Kaleroe. After all, there are both hot springs and cold springs located there. So in the same way that ancient cultures believed that the gods regulated the weather for their crops, the temperature of the water was likely believed to be regulated by the fallen angels. Let's continue.
Chapter 68. And after that my grandfather Enoch gave me the teaching of all the secrets in the book in the parables which had been given him. And he put them together for me in the words of the book of the parables.
Now, this first verse of chapter 68 is the conclusion of the insert from Noah. In it, we're told that Enoch gave Noah the book of the parables, and he explained to Noah what it all meant. In other words, he shared with Noah the same thing that he's been sharing with us, which is primarily that the judgment of the fallen angels is a two-part judgment. The first part was their binding in the days of Noah, where they would ultimately await their final judgment, which is scheduled to happen in the end days when Christ returns, exactly as Enoch has been describing in the book of the parables. Let's continue.
And on that day, Michael answered Raphael and said, "The power of the Spirit transports and makes me to tremble because of the severity of the judgment of the secrets, the judgment of the angels. Who can endure the severe judgment which has been executed and before which they melt away?" And Michael answered again and said to Raphael, "Who is he whose heart is not softened concerning it, and whose reins are not troubled by this word of judgment that hath gone forth upon them because of those who have thus led them out?" And it came to pass, when he stood before the Lord of spirits, Michael said thus to Raphael, "I will not take their part under the eye of the Lord. For the Lord of spirits has been angry with them, because they do as if they were the Lord. Therefore all that is hidden shall come upon them for ever and ever. For neither angel nor man shall have his portion in it, but alone they have received their judgment for ever and ever."
So at this point, it appears that we are back in the original writings of Enoch. If you remember, we left off with Enoch witnessing the souls of the kings of earth descending into hell. And Enoch made mention that there were certain faces already there, which was a reference to the fallen angels who have been bound there since the days of Noah. So just to offer a quick recap, the believers in Christ have been raptured, followed by the Jews who realized their mistake, repented, and were saved as well. The kings of earth and the wicked have been burned in the valley of Hinnom, and their souls descended into hell. And the last thing on the list is the permanent destruction of the fallen angels. If you remember from chapter 54, Enoch said that on that day, Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, and Phanuel will cast the fallen angels into the burning furnace, what the book of Revelation refers to as the lake of fire. And it appears as though we're picking up in Enoch at that very moment. We're told that on that day, Michael turns to Raphael and undoubtedly expresses sympathy for the fallen angels. He says that their judgment makes him tremble, and he essentially says, who wouldn't be sympathetic and who wouldn't be troubled by the severity of the judgment that's being given to them? But although he can sympathize with what they're about to experience, he also makes it clear that he wouldn't dream of interfering. He recognizes that their judgment comes at the command of God, and therefore it's not his place to interfere. He even goes so far as to say that he wouldn't presume to take on the authority of God, something that the watchers had done when they transgressed. If you remember from Isaiah chapter 14, Lucifer himself said, quote, "I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High," unquote. But here, Michael is humbling himself and making it known that God is sovereign, which seems to be his pattern. If you remember from the book of Jude, we're told that when Michael was sent to collect the body of Moses, and he ends up arguing with Lucifer over who had rights to it, he didn't dare condemn or slander Lucifer. Rather than saying, "I rebuke you," he instead said, "The Lord rebuke you." So again, he reacted with humility and reverence for the power of God, something that the fallen angels didn't do. And therefore, Michael goes on to confirm that their punishment came at their own hands. It's their own fault, because they shared knowledge that should have never been shared, and it wasn't accidental. As we witnessed in the Book of the Watchers, and as we're about to see in the following chapter, They knew that what they were doing was wrong, and yet they planned out how to do it and made a pact with each other to go through with it. It was a premeditated rebellion against God by targeting His creation, and therefore their punishment matched their crime. Which is why chapter 69 opens with Enoch saying that because of the severity of the punishment that they are given, no angel would dare repeat these offenses because they were all made to witness the destruction of the fallen angels. Let's continue.
Chapter 69. And after this judgment they shall terrify and make them to tremble, because they have shown this to those who dwell on the earth. And behold the names of those angels, and these are their names. The first of them is Samjazah, the second Artikifa, the third Amen, the fourth Kokobel, the fifth Turiel, the sixth Rumjal, the seventh Danjal, the eighth Nekael, the ninth Barakel, the tenth Azazel, the 11th Amaros, the 12th Batajal, the 13th Busasajel, the 14th Hananel, the 15th Turel, and the 16th Simapesiel, the 17th Jetrel, the 18th Tumael, the 19th Turel, the 20th Rumael, the 21st Azazel. And these are the chiefs of their angels and their names, and their chief ones over hundreds and over fifties and over tens.
So here Enoch basically lists off the leaders of the fallen angels, just like he had done in the Book of the Watchers, basically to verify for the reader that these are in fact the same angels that descended in the days of Jared to corrupt mankind. And you'll notice that many of the names are identical, but there are a few names which are different. Dr. Michael Heiser suggests that this is due to the original names likely being in Aramaic, whereas the names written here may have been derived from a Greek translation of the text. The meaning of the names, however, remains the same. They still translate to mean things like lightning of God, thunder of God, star of God, etc., exactly as we saw in the Book of the Watchers. And we're told that these are the chiefs of the angels, which could either mean that they were placed in these leadership positions over the various ranks of the 200 angels who descended, or, as we said in the Book of the Watchers, it might also imply that these were angels in leadership positions over the very areas which their name represents. For example, the chief angel over thunder, or the chief angel over lightning, and so on. In other words, high-ranking angels who actually formed this rebellion and subsequently led it. Let's continue.
The name of the first, Jekon, that is the one who led astray all the sons of God and brought them down to the earth and led them astray through the daughters of men. The second was named Azabiel. He imparted to the holy sons of God evil counsel and led them astray so that they defiled their bodies with the daughters of men. And the third was named Gadriel. He it is who showed the children of men all the blows of death. And he led astray Eve, and showed the weapons of death to the sons of men, the shield, and the coat of mail, and the sword for battle, and all the weapons of death to the children of men. And from his hand they have proceeded against those who dwell on the earth from that day and forevermore.
So here we see Enoch once again describe how each of the angels were responsible for corrupting mankind, and the list is divided into two groups. The first two angels were instrumental in the corruption of genetics. These were the angels who led the charge to mate with the women of Earth. Whereas the remaining angels listed are involved in the corruption of knowledge. They reveal secrets to humanity, and we're even told in further detail what specifically they share. First up is Gadriel, who taught the art of war, the making of weapons, and specifically how to deliver blows that would kill. In fact, in the next section, Enoch says that mankind was originally created to be like the angels, to be pure and righteous and live forever. But then they were taught how to literally destroy each other. And here's something fascinating. Dr. Michael Heiser broke down the etymology of Gadriel's name. And he suggests that this angel may have manipulated mankind into putting their faith in these weapons rather than God by claiming that the weapons were an extension of God's help and protection. Now, how deceitful is that? What's even more shocking is that we're told that this is the very angel, Gadriel, who was responsible for also deceiving Eve in the Garden of Eden. And Dr. Michael Heiser claims that Gadriel in the Book of the Parables acts as sort of a counterpart to Azazel, that in other translations, even the name Gadriel is often interchangeable with the name Azazel. After all, in the Book of the Watchers, it was Azazel who taught mankind the art of war and weaponry, whereas in this passage, it's Gadriel. So if they are in fact associated or the same entity, then this would draw a very strong connection between Azazel from the Book of Enoch and the biblical Satan, the chief adversary, who not only deceived Eve in the Garden of Eden, but came back to deceive all of mankind in the most violent of ways. Let's continue.
And the fourth was named Penemue. He taught the children of men the bitter and the sweet, and he taught them all the secrets of their wisdom. And he instructed mankind in writing with ink and paper, and thereby many sinned from eternity to eternity, and until this day. For men were not created for such a purpose, to give confirmation to their good faith with pen and ink. For men were created exactly like the angels, to the intent that they should continue pure and righteous, and death, which destroys everything, could not have taken hold of them. But through this, their knowledge, they are perishing. And through this power, it is consuming me.
So here we're told that they taught mankind how to write. And shockingly, Enoch claims that this was specifically taught for the purpose of preserving corrupt knowledge, so that mankind would continue to perpetuate it. Which just proves how calculated this attack was. It wasn't solely intended to corrupt just the people who were on earth at that time. They intended for this corruption to reverberate throughout all of human history, which it has. And not only that, but we're told that the knowledge that mankind was taught to preserve through writing was bitter and sweet, which means that they taught what was evil as though it were good, and they taught what was good as though it were evil. They deceived mankind into believing that they were serving God while blatantly disrespecting Him. We're told in Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20, quote, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter," unquote. Let's continue.
And the fifth was named Kazdijah. This is he who showed the children of men all the wicked smitings of spirits and demons, and the smitings of the embryo in the womb that it may pass away, and the smitings of the soul, the bites of the serpent, and the smitings which befall through the noontide heat. The son of the serpent named Tabaaet.
Here we're told that they also taught men how to conjure spirits and smite demons. Now, in this context, the term smite doesn't necessarily mean to hit or to strike, but it instead means something more like the word smitten, to attract. In other words, they taught mankind how to conjure or attract demonic spirits. And same as before, Dr. Michael Heiser breaks down the etymology of the name of the angel who supposedly taught this and connected him to an ancient group of people who may have ultimately been named after him, the Caldu, who eventually became known as the Chaldeans. Now, the Caldu were a people from southern Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar's father was considered Caldu, and they were known as the Babylonian sages, the pagan wise men, prophets, and priests of Babylon. They were the guardians of ancient lore and the preservers of the fallen angel knowledge. And there was an ancient Greek historian, Diodorus Siculus, who wrote that the Chaldeans held a very high position in Babylon because they were assigned to the service of the gods. And therefore, they spent their entire life in study of what was essentially the fallen angel knowledge. He claims that they were particularly adept at soothsaying, which is knowledge of the future. He said that they could make accurate predictions about future events, either through sacrifices or watching bird patterns or even studying the entrails of animals, and that they would cast charms in an attempt to affect the outcome of the future, to either avert evil or to attract good. And we see this practice even today with modern-day fortune tellers, tarot card readers, palm readers. And in season one of the podcast, we talked about the very real U.S. government programs who today use people with these abilities to help predict future global events. In fact, I was listening to Trey Smith recently from God in a Nutshell, who was talking about the famous South African prophet Kim Clement. And in that documentary, Kim Clement's family happened to casually mention that Kim was so accurate in his predictions of the future that the CIA here in the United States approached him to work in their Looking Glass program, which is the very program that utilizes basically modern-day seers to predict the future. Now, I want to clarify here that Kim Clement was a very strong Christian, and his predictions came from God as a warning to believers. But this is the power that the fallen angels were trying to replicate as a counterfeit of God's power. But theirs was manifested through demonic spirits. Now, Enoch goes on to say that this same angel who taught mankind how to conjure and attract demons also taught abortion. In fact, there is evidence throughout ancient Jewish literature that abortions were once viewed as the function of demons, which could be controlled through magic. There's actually a very specific demon in ancient Jewish culture who was widely known for her obsession with killing babies, Lilith. In Mesopotamia, she was known as Lamashtu. She's not only a very ancient mythological figure that can be found across cultures, but she's described as one of the oldest female spirits in the world. In Irish mythology, she's described as the patron saint of abortions. She's also often described as part serpent, which may very well be why Enoch describes abortions in connection to the bites of the serpent. And as we approach the end of today's episode, I just want to give you a heads up that I'm going to play this last section of chapter 69, but I'm only going to offer a summary of chapters 70 and 71. These last two chapters are long, but the message they offer is really simple. So for time's sake, I'm just going to share the meat of the message, and you're welcome to read them on your own if you like. Let's continue.
And this is the task of Kazbael, the chief of the oath which he showed to the holy ones when he dwelt high above in glory, and its name is Bica. This angel requested Michael to show him the hidden name, that he might enunciate it in the oath, so that those might quake before that name and oath who revealed all that was in secret to the children of man. And this is the power of this oath, for it is powerful and strong. And he placed this oath, Akee, in the hand of Michael. And these are the secrets of this oath. And they are strong through this oath. And the heaven was suspended before the world was created and forever. And through it the earth was founded upon the water, and from the secret recesses of the mountains came beautiful waters, from the creation of the world and unto eternity. And through that oath the sea was created. And as its foundation, he set for it the sand against the time of its anger, and it dare not pass beyond it from the creation of the world unto eternity. And through that oath are the depths made fast, and abide and stir not from their place, from eternity to eternity. And through that oath the sun and moon complete their course, and deviate not from their ordinance from eternity to eternity. And through that oath the stars complete their course, and he calls them by their names, and they answer him from eternity to eternity. And in like manner, the spirits of the water and of the winds and of all zephyrs and their paths from all the quarters of the winds. And there are preserved the voices of the thunder and the light of the lightnings. And there are preserved the chambers of the hail and the chambers of the hoarfrost and the chambers of the mist and the chambers of the rain and the dew. And all these believe and give thanks before the Lord of spirits and glorify him with all their power. And their food is in every act of thanksgiving. They thank and glorify and extol the name of the Lord of spirits for ever and ever. And this oath is mighty over them, and through it they are preserved, and their paths are preserved, and their course is not destroyed. Close of the third parable. And there was great joy amongst them, and they blessed and glorify and extol, because the name of that Son of Man had been revealed unto them. And he sat on the throne of his glory, and the sum of judgment was given unto the Son of Man. And he caused the sinners to pass away and be destroyed from off the face of the earth, and those who would have led the world astray. With chains shall they be bound, and in their assemblage place of destruction shall they be imprisoned, and all their works vanish from the face of the earth. And from henceforth there shall be nothing corruptible, for that Son of Man has appeared, and has seated himself on the throne of his glory, and all evil shall pass away before his face. And the word of that Son of Man shall go forth and be strong before the Lord of spirits. This is the third parable of Enoch.
So in this final section of the text, an angel is named who, according to Enoch, once ranked very high in heaven. And it appears as though this angel, Becca, collaborated with Michael before the universe was ever created to put the secret name of the Messiah into a powerful oath. And we're not only told that the oath was powerful and strong, but that it was possibly used in the creation of the universe, which might actually be what John meant when he spoke about Jesus as the Word in John chapter 1. Quote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," unquote. We're also told by Enoch that a part of this oath included the Messiah's name being the foundation of a covenant which would provide redemption, what we know today as the redemption of mankind. And these two ideas combined confirm what we've said in previous episodes, that at the moment when God created the universe, before mankind was ever created or had ever sinned, the Messiah existed. And God placed the story of redemption in the sun, moon, and stars as a witness for all of eternity. God always had a plan. And the foundation of all things in heaven and on earth was always Christ. We're told in Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, "By him were all things created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." And that's basically the end of the book of the parables. Now, chapters 70 and 71 are considered additions to the book of the parables, and they basically cover Enoch's translation into heaven. In fact, if we skip to chapter 81, we're actually given a bit more insight into what happened in between the time that Enoch witnesses all of this and when he was translated. According to chapter 81, after Enoch is shown all of the secrets of heaven, he's returned to earth by three angels who give him 1 year to share his knowledge with his children, after which time they promise to return and take him back to heaven to live. And this is where chapter 70 picks up. We're told in chapter 70 that Enoch was carried to heaven in a chariot, very similar to the prophet Elijah, who was also raptured in a fiery chariot in the book of 2 Kings. So technically, chapter 71 is considered to have been written after Enoch transcends into heaven. In it, he describes much of what he shared with us already: the secrets of heaven, the temple of God, the seraphim, the cherubim, the ophanim, and the watchers, all surrounding the throne of God, and 10,000 times 10,000 standing in the heavenly temple of God. He also describes God as wearing spectacular clothing beyond description and greeting Enoch upon his arrival alongside the Son of Man, Christ. He goes on to say that God refers to him as the epitome of justice, saying that peace would follow Enoch in the world to come, which some believe to be a hidden reference to Enoch's return in the world to come during the Messianic Kingdom, or rather the time frame leading up to the Messianic Kingdom. We're told in Hebrews chapter 9 that it is appointed unto all men once to die, and after that, judgment. But both Enoch and Elijah were spared the experience of a physical death on earth, and therefore, many speculate whether they might actually be the two witnesses spoken of in the book of Revelation, the two prophets who preach in the streets during the most perilous time on earth, and who are ultimately killed by the Antichrist and their bodies left on display for 3.5 days, when they will miraculously return to life and ascend into heaven in front of the whole world. So it's possible that this reference to peace following Enoch into the world to come might actually be a hinting at his return in the end days. And that's a wrap for the book of the parables. As I said earlier, there are 108 chapters total in this first book of Enoch, and we've only covered 71 of them. So I'm going to take an extra episode to offer a brief overview of what's found in the remaining chapters. So our season isn't quite finished yet, but it's quickly coming to an end. And in case you weren't aware, I'll be taking a few months off over the summer to not only spend some time with my daughter while school is out, but also to gear up for the Book of Revelation study, which I plan to kick off in August, if I can wait that long. But I won't be gone completely. I'll likely share some bonus episodes over the summer in order to keep in touch during the break. I'll also be accessible all summer long on social media. And while I'm thinking about it, it's probably a good time to remind you to hit the subscribe button on the podcast just to make sure that you get notified every time new episodes are posted, specifically when I share them sporadically over the summer. And with that, if you've enjoyed today's episode, there's a couple different ways that you can show some support. At the top of my website, there's a donate button if you'd like to offer a one-time gift, or you can leave me a review on whichever platform you're using. Reviews bring a ton of credibility for those who aren't familiar with my show. If you're interested in accessing the script notes from today's episode, head over to my website and become a member. Membership is $10 a month, and you get access to the script notes and reference materials for all of my episodes. You can also find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Truth Social at Ancient Conspiracies. I'll be sure to include the links for all of these in the description of today's episode. And as I said before, make sure to hit that subscribe button if you haven't already, and share this podcast with a friend. We'll see you next time.